It started. We do not yet have a quorum, but we will begin with the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Today we will work our way through the governor's budget recommendations and presentations, and we are going to begin with the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, Robert Oppheim from the State Ombudsman. Please welcome to the committee and please proceed.
Chairman Dean and members of the committee, my name is Roberta Oppheim, and I'm the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I'll try to balance between those of you who already have familiarity with our function and those of you who might be new, and try not to drag down the presentation for too long. The Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities is an independent state agency that answers directly to the governor. We're not part of DHS, and a lot of people do confuse that. We're independent. We provide direct services to citizens that have mental health, developmental disabilities, chemical dependency, and emotional disturbance issues and needs for services. Our agency function involves an effort to resolve or prevent complaints in an effort to resolve them in a sort of non-legal manner, try and prevent the need for appeals and lawsuits. And oftentimes those complaints about the services or about the way people are treated in services, much of it relates to ineffective communication. So to the extent that we can facilitate, mediate a better outcome for everybody, we try to do that before the before it becomes necessary to go to court. We also have a function that we review deaths and serious injuries. They are required to be reported to us by agencies, facilities, and programs within 24 hours. Serious injury is defined in law. And the purpose of that is to find ways to prevent in the future occurrences. So based on what we see in a death or a serious injury, it's not that a given entity did something bad, but more about what does the whole system look like? Were there things that could have improved the situation? So we're looking more to improve the system, not so much for the... There are other boards and agencies that actually... health licensing boards and others that can look at any given provider. But ours is to look and see if we can educate the system. We do medical updates, medical alerts. If something critical comes out of the FDA, we have a system to notify people. We also are home to the Civil Commitment Training and Resource Center, where, again, every civil commitment costs money in legal costs and human costs and social service costs. And to the extent that our trainings can inform people in a way that we only focus on the legitimate need, that hopefully we can prevent costs there. And then we also look at systemic issues, current systemic issues that are a big driver of workload in our agency are the Jensen Settlement Agreement and the Olmstead Plan. I am an ex officio member of the governor's sub-cabinet on Olmstead, and my role is to advise related to Olmstead, what it means, what its effects are on the individual citizens. Haven't had an opportunity yet this session to meet with each of you individually, but we certainly hope that we'll be able to do that throughout the individual session. In the budget itself, our base currently sits at $1.654 million annually, or $3.308 for the biennium. What we have found over time is that inflation has chipped away at our ability to continue to do the function in an effective member at the manner. At the same time, our calls, our reviews are increasing both in complexity and numbers. The budget pages show for 16-17 without a base adjustment our staffing would continue to go down. The staffing of the agency at its highest point was 21 staff members. I've been here 21 years, and I've never been able to get it to that level. And so we have tried everything we can to be more effective with our resources, find ways to cut costs, and still be able to serve the individuals we serve. The governor has recommended that we receive a base adjustment in order for us not to lose any staff because of the nature and complexity of the work. That is the first budget change item, and it's 113 in 2016 and 228 in 2017. That should allow for any salary increases that are negotiated and for us, again, not to have to cut staff to continue to do just the base work we do today. The second item in the governor's budget that he has recommended for us is specifically two positions specifically related to the Jensen settlement agreement and the Olmstead case. The Olmstead plan. I cannot tell you the exponential amount of additional meetings for both myself and my staff to move this forward. The system all over the place is in constant change. We are what I would call an ad hoc quality assurance mechanism for the state. In other words, we're not reviewing all the number crunching and surveying, but as cases come to us, we see where the system is or is not working, and we attempt to feed that back to the Department of Human Services, Department of Health, or other agencies to ensure that they're aware of what's happening to people and how we can improve the system. So that proposal is for two additional staff in order to focus primarily on the Jensen settlement agreement and the Olmstead plan. And with that, I would stand for any questions. There is on the governor's budget pages that you have, and I'm not sure how your page numbering goes because we just printed off our pages, but in the first change item, it shows 113 and 228, but the narrative shows 133. The graph is correct, 113, not the 133.
Thank you, Ms. Oppheim. And members, we do now have a quorum, so we're going to go ahead and call the meeting to order, and Representative Franson would like to move the minutes from February 3rd and 4th, 2015. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes from those? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Ms. Oppheim, one of the things that you had brought up was the additional services that are going to be required as a result of what you're seeing with Jensen Olmstead work that you're doing. Could you just talk just very briefly about how that would come to you, how you're dealing with it, and how you're handling those issues?
I'd be happy to. Chairman Dean and members of the committee, in 2008, our office wrote a report about the use of handcuffs and leg hobbles on individual clients with developmental disabilities. And we had been researching it and investigating it for a couple of years. We wrote a report and made a number of recommendations to the Department of Human Services because it was a state-operated facility that this was going on in. Later, some of the individuals who had been restrained filed a class action lawsuit against the state of Minnesota and the Department of Human Services for the what they deemed to be the illegal use of seclusion restraint for things that were not appropriate for the use of seclusion and restraint. That settlement agreement was approved by the court in 2011. There were a number of things the department agreed to do, including changing the way we have rules around seclusion and restraint, and also to develop an Olmstead plan, as well as any mitigation to the individual class members. Within the first year, there were a number of items that were not approved. Were not approved by the court because DHS, by their own admission, was not making the progress. So they'd report not completed. At that point, the federal court judge appointed a court monitor and asked that our agency and the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities become consultants to all the parties, to the court monitor, to the court, to the plaintiffs and the defendants, and try to keep things moving forward. I can't even begin to tell you the number of meetings, to the point where I'm not even able to get to all of my, what I would call, day-to-day work for the operation of our agency. Plus, we get a lot more phone calls, and if the depending upon the situation, we then need to get them forwarded to the right individuals, or we need to open a case to see whether or not they're meeting the standards of the rule and law, which is our normal function. But in addition, anything related to the Jensen settlement agreement. So what we need to do is free up more of our administrative time to be able to work on the Jensen settlement agreement, and that means someone has to be doing the other tasks. But also, there are more meetings than I can humanly attend because both of those items have subgroups, and I have been assigning some of the staff who are familiar with this or who were part of the investigation to be part of the subgroup because it's not possible for me to personally attend every one of them. But one of the secondary issues that has phenomenally changed our workload, as part of the redoing of, instead of what was Rule 40, the planned use of aversive procedures, seclusion, restraint, mechanical and manual restraints, there was a requirement to rewrite what was Rule 40 and instead develop a positive support rule. What should facilities programs be doing and training on in order to prevent the need for seclusion and restraint? And restraint is still allowed in any kind of life or harm situation, but it has to be a manual restraint. But in the meantime, plans have to be developed for each client that are person-centered and designed to say, you know, what could be done based on our knowledge of this individual to mitigate and prevent them from escalating to a point where they might need to be restrained. And one of the examples on that, although it wasn't for persons with developmental disabilities, but the security hospital, one of the things we discovered and was reported to us when they had the murder was that although that happened in the late afternoon, early evening, the client that did that had been asking to see a psychiatrist all day long and had not been given an opportunity to meet with the psychiatrist. So this is, the whole thing is, what can you see up front? Are they dysregulated in the morning? How are, you know, what are things we can do to prevent them from escalating to that point? But in addition to that, there is a requirement that the use of seclusion and restraints be reported to the Department of Human Services in our office. And in the first 7 months, so we take a look at those to see, is there a systemic issue or the recommendations that could be made. Primarily, that's DHS's job. We are more of a backup quality assurance to make sure people are reporting. There were 13,000 of those in like the first 7 or 8 months. 13,000. My staff are directed to look within the database, find those within their region, and review those. So it exponentially increased the day-to-day work of the staff within the agency. So we need someone to help with the systemic piece of this, to assist in pulling some of this together in a way that doesn't force our individual staff that are covering the regions to be forced away from serving the individual clients that we have, and to help us inform the court monitor, help us inform DHS and all the parties about best practices, about where their system may not be functioning as well. You know, I think the people at DHS are very committed to improving the care and treatment, but often what's put on paper on a wall and a flow chart will train these people, doesn't always operationalize itself. And so our role is, when it's not operationalizing itself, we need to get in there and assist and make recommendations and inform the department of that.
Thank you, Ms. Hopheim. Other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question. I just, I've had the opportunity to work with Ms. Hopheim and observe her office, and I just really wanted to commend her and for the work that she does. I don't know if Minnesotans really know how fortunate we are to have her on the job. And I don't know a lot of her staff personally, but I can only imagine. I mean, this woman is really a bulldog for the people that really need somebody there for them. And I just wanted to say that on the record now, since we're here listening to the budget request. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree that this is a really valuable service, and it's a protection, an escape valve for a strained system to find out where those strains are and how to adjust and correct for them. I was surprised by your 13,000 reports of use of restraints and seclusion over 7 months, and it'd be helpful if, and I don't know if it's your responsibility, the Department of Human Services, you said there's some kind of shared responsibilities here, to know if we're making progress on those going down now that we're training staff, now that we're, you know, implementing some of the requirements of the Jensen settlement, and if we're seeing a shift in any way in terms of the number of reports that come from state-operated services versus privately operated services, and just kind of a, you know, a big picture view of how is the system evolving, because a lot of effort's being put into trying to change the system, but it'd be, I'm hoping it'll eventually be a lot less reports to you, even though some will always be necessary.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Ms. Hopheim.
Representative Dean, Chairman Dean, and Representative Loeffler, I have to say that at this moment in time, I don't know what the current total is, and I have not seen the graph yet to see if it is going up or going down. What I can tell you is during this time of immense change, there is so much confusion and misinformation floating out in the provider community, even amongst DHS staff. And at a recent meeting, I indicated that somehow a better job needs to be done, communicated, so that when someone who works for DHS, whether they're a policy division person or state-operated or a trainer, that we're giving consistent information to providers. So right now I see that we're kind of in the eye of the storm and the turmoil that goes with change from the way things are going. But I will take a look and see if I can get a better handle on the numbers and whether it's broken down by state-operated versus DHS. I'll see if DHS can get me those numbers. That's primarily their responsibility. They're supposed to review them, refer to licensing, or contact the provider if something is going wrong. But we found for a very long period of time we were the only ones that were doing those reviews. So I think it's a lot of everybody getting the act together and getting it done in the most efficient manner possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony today and for all your good work.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have from the Disability Council, Joan Wilshire, the Executive Director.
Okay. Good afternoon. I've got a few handouts and materials that I will give the page, so you got a few of those as well. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. MSGOD was created in 1973 as an independent state agency statutorily mandated to advise the governor, state legislature, state agencies, and public regarding disability issues. Currently, MSGOD operates with a staffing complement of 6.1 FTEs. Our baseline budget is $618,000 a year. I also report to a council of 17 Minnesotans who are appointed by the governor. Council members are generally people with disabilities, family members of people with disabilities, and professionals that interact with people with disabilities. In the 41 years, MSGOD has responded to over a quarter of a million requests for technical assistance from businesses, employers, state agencies, people with disabilities, and the general public. The key issues MSGOD focuses on are in the area of federal and state laws relating to civil rights, disability rights, such as the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, Human Rights Act, Minnesota's Olmstead Plan, and the Section 508 of the Rehab Act. But more specifically, the areas we work on are in building code and accessibility, disability parking, employment and transportation policy, emergency preparedness and management, and of course, ADA, specifically Title II issues as they pertain to the Olmstead decision. So how do we go about addressing all these issues with 6.1 FTEs? MSGOD consults with the Minnesota Legislature, the Office of the Governor, Office of Secretary of State, and numerous other state agencies to improve accessibility of government and government services to ensure compliance with the ADA. We also partner with disability nonprofit organizations as well as other government entities to advise and advocate for the full inclusion in society for people with disabilities. MSGOD engages their stakeholders in a variety of ways, through direct access to one another via live events, our town hall meetings, legislative forums, via web and video-based conferences, so all voices are heard. MSGOD also conducts many trainings to the public and private employers and state employees on various disability issues. MSGOD provides professional technical assistance to the following areas: building officials, emergency managers, architects, attorneys, employers, businesses, and others on the federal and state laws relating to civil rights and the disability rights, such as the ADA. MSGOD also represents the disability community on various advisory boards. It's well over 50, and many of these are in statute. If you look at our statute, besides our enabling statute, that's 256.48, we have an additional 15 statutes that bring us in conversation with many different departments. And these boards address issues from voting rights, many human services issues, transportation, building code development and enforcement, accessibility, access to public buildings in particular, major sports facilities, the ongoing implementation of the ADA with state government. And MSGOD just serves as a representation, again, representing the disability community, not only on these committees statewide, but in the Twin Cities area, too. So MSGOD sees its priorities as ensuring programmatic and physical and sensory access to government, education, employment, transportation, commerce, and recreation for all. MSGOD is charged with holding policymakers and state agencies accountable to disability-related civil rights laws in an effort to ensure the full inclusion and participation in society for all Minnesotans. We are really the state's consultant to state agencies and the public regarding the ADA issues in particular. It's not just about removing the physical access so people with disabilities can get into buildings. It's also about the programmatic piece, too. Can people access the documents and or the websites? This is just another example of the work that MSGOD focuses on. MSGOD is unique in that we are the only state agency that provides technical assistance in regard to the ADA. We are sought after for best practices on accessibility as a consultant resource in much of Minnesota's building professionals. Some of the work we've done, the Target Stadium, it's now known as one of the most accessible stadiums in the nation. Viking Stadium, we're kind of dragging the NFL to the table there. They're not quite as fun as the Twins were, but we're bringing that together. Saints Ballpark's going to be fabulous. And, of course, our own Capitol right next door, we're doing a lot of work on the accessibility piece there. So, as we look to celebrate the 25th anniversary of our landmark civil rights legislation, the ADA, this July 26th, it's going to be at the Minnesota History Center. I'm officially inviting you all to save that date, July 26th, to come to our big event. So that kind of concludes my presentation, and I've got materials that we can hand out so you can see all of our publications. I don't know where they are. That might be something we could do right now, because we've got a wonderful list of publications. Not only can you get them in this capacity, but also on our website, and they're all fully accessible as well. So that concludes my presentation. I welcome any comments.
Thank you so much. And any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this year we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the Olmstead-Jensen settlements and its implications for our service delivery system and how it's going to transition and change over time. And one of the key parts of that is making sure that people with all disabilities have a chance to work in the most independent and integrated settings possible. And some states have gotten to 70% of employment of people with disabilities, and I see from the background here that we're at 47%. You know, as you see this rollout of Olmstead going forward, you know, do you feel, we heard from Ms. Olpine from the Ombudsman Office about the demands on her office. Do you feel like you're able to kind of ramp up with the processes and the publications you've worked with to help meet that need?
Ms. Wilshire. Yep.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler and committee members, we have great concern about being able to continually meet our statutory obligations. With the current recommendation of our appropriation moving forward, we see huge deficits in terms of being able to just do what we're supposed to be doing. As Roberta Olpheim had just suggested, there's so many meetings, and we're being requested to attend so many things, and I have only 6.1 staff, three of which are professional staff that can and work on specific areas. My accessibility specialist, she's the one that handles all of the building code, disability parking, emergency preparedness, and she's looking to retire in 2 years, so I'm trying to do some succession planning before she retires. That's going to be a huge gaping hole. So, and then with Olmstead, that's another huge opportunity. Even though we were not asked to be a part of the sub-cabinet, we attend those meetings, and we're asked for to attend to participate on that committee. And so we are very concerned, and my board is, as I report to the board, very concerned how we're going to meet those statutory obligations.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's something we need to think about.
Great. Representative Helps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I just wanted to point out that we actually had a situation in Dakota County where we needed some guidance on some development plans for some parks and open space, and Ms. Scott came out and provided some really important advice to our local units of government. And what I saw was that it really saved a lot of time and resources at the county level and city level when these questions came up, that there was a resources available that they could tap into at the state level and really help the efficiency of that planning process. So thanks for that.
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes saving a lot of money mm-hmm. for having Absolutely. To redo this stuff. We appreciate that especially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. If there's no other questions, I think the next we have the Ombudsman for Families. If you'd like to come forward, whoever is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Dean and committee members. My name is Muriel Gubasta, and I'm an ombudsman with the state agency, the Office of Ombudsperson for Families, working with Minnesota Spanish-speaking families on child protection issues. For those of you who are not familiar with the Office of Ombudsperson for Families, just to give you a quick picture, the agency was created in 1991 by the Minnesota Legislature, and it was created in response to community concerns or from families who had been negatively impacted because of their involvement with a local service, with a local child welfare agency, hence a child protection case being opened. In particular, the agency focuses on reducing racial disparities that exist in Minnesota's child welfare system. And I'm going to defer to my colleague, Ann, to continue to speak on this issue.
Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dean and members of the committee. My name is Ann Hill, and I am with the Office of Ombudspersons for Families. Muriel is correct. The Office of Ombudsperson was created in 1991, and it was created in response to the growing number of children in out-of-home placement, and particularly the disparate representation of American Indian children and African American children, and the growing number of Latino children who were coming into the state at the time. We were created to ensure that government agencies, particularly child placing agencies, child welfare agencies, respond appropriately to children in need of protection throughout the state, and for children residing in state care and children and families under state supervision due to allegations or findings of child abuse and neglect. The office was also intended to promote public awareness about the child welfare system and to recommend and facilitate broad-based systemic improvements. And I can say to each one of you, to some extent, we've accomplished that. When this office was created, Minnesota had more than 18,000 kids in out-of-home placement. And with our kind of rigorous involvement with policy work with throughout the state and working with counties, those numbers have been reduced to now about 11,000 kids in out-of-home placement in the state of Minnesota. Now, all hasn't been just great. We still have disparities, as some of you know, and we continue to work on those issues, each and every one of us. There are four people. There are actually, we have five FTEs in the office. Four of us are ombudsmen. We focus on, but our focus is specifically, our focus is children of color, but we take complaints from anyone who calls, and our plates are usually full. As you can see, our numbers, we get many, many calls about the child welfare system, and many of us are out of the office, in court, at Department of Human Services, or at counties, responding to complaints about how children can have our children can have better outcomes in child welfare system. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Jill Kehalani Ash. I'm the American Indian Ombudsperson for Families. We do have another ombudsperson, Bao Ning Chu, who sends her regrets that she's not able to be here, and she works for the Asian Pacific Islander group.
You can talk about the budget? Yeah.
We're going to switch back over to the budget. For fiscal year, can you hear me?
Yep.
I know I'm kind of going like this.
Stretch but a little bit there. I think that picks you up pretty well.
Thanks. So for fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15, the Office of Ombudspersons for Families' base budget was $334,000. And that's for the general fund. As you have heard from Ann Hill, the agency, things are not all that great in the sense of we continue to receive a lot of complaints, and the number of calls, inquiries, and complaints that the agency receives has increased from 2011, 2012 to 2013, 2014. And I believe that you should have the fast fact sheets showing that information. With the appropriation in fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15 of $334,000, that was just to the general fund, and the general fund is utilized to pay for the salaries of the four ombudsmen. However, that was not enough, so consequently we had to dip into the agency's special fund appropriation, which is an appropriation of $92,000 from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Then when we do that, that special fund from the Minnesota Department of Human Services that reduces the amount of money that we have for our operating expenses. So we would like to say thank you for your support in supporting Governor Dayton's recommendation of the 1.8% operating increase to our general fund appropriation to increase for fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 17 our base budget to, or the amount that we had requested is $177,000. That will enable us to maintain and keep the 5 full-time employees. Without having a full-time office administrative specialist, that gets in the way of the ombudspersons performing their statutory duties of hearing the complaints on child protection matters, going to court to monitor the cases. And when we don't have a full-time office administrative specialist, then those tasks come to us. So with this additional funding that we're receiving, it will now allow us to have a full-time office administrative specialist who will focus on the financial management and reporting aspects of the Office of Ombudsperson for Families, so that the 4 full-time ombudspersons are free to really focus on the complaints that we receive regarding the child protection matters.
Thank you. Others? Questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for your testimony today and for coming in. We sure appreciate it and appreciate all the work that you're doing, and look forward to working together throughout the session and the process.
Could I say something on behalf of the American Indian Ombudspersons?
Absolutely.
And the fast facts that are before you on the back of that, we have examples of the complaints received and resolved by the office. And what I focused on was the non-compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. And because of that, of the numbers that we have for the calls into the office and the investigations that our office has had, more than a third of that is for the American Indian community. So as a result of that, it is extremely difficult, because as the American Indian Ombudsperson for Families, I not only work with all the counties and the 11, I'm the liaison for the 11 tribes in Minnesota, I also work throughout the nation for the 566 federally recognized tribes. So if a case is in child protection and it's in one of the 87 counties, but they are a member of a tribe in California, Wisconsin, or Nevada, I also get those telephone calls. So it's extremely difficult without more monies for us, for me particularly, to be able to provide the service that we really need for the children that are in, you know, out of home placement, especially for the American Indians, because under the American Indians, we do have 2 different laws that are different from the other communities, and that being the Indian Child Welfare Act and the MIFPA, which is the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. So because of that, they have different rules, and the compliance statewide by the counties not complying with it, it makes it extremely difficult for me to work with the cases, because I'm trying to educate the counties on complying with the rules that are in there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point is, you know, there's a study group that's going on currently looking at the response of counties in the state to child protection cases, and is looking at better, I know we've heard from the Department of Human Services that they're looking at better training and oversight of county actions in this area. Is your concerns about enough training about the Indian Child Welfare Act being included in that development, or is that something we need to encourage?
I think that needs to be encouraged. I just had a conversation with Judge Kevin Marks earlier this week, and I spoke to Judge Marks. This is the best way to get the judges on the bench to remind the county attorneys about the rules, because the counties are not following the rules. And so he provided me with an avenue on how I can contact all the chief judges throughout the state and to remind the judges that they need to have the counties follow that. But because of that, I'm only one person and working with policy. In the meantime, we have all these other cases regarding child protection. And so it makes it extremely difficult with our, you know, not having enough monies in our budget to be able to do everything that needs to be done.
Thank you, Ms. Hess. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I know up north where I represent Leech Lake Reservation, they've got the tribal court has the jurisdiction, recognition with the counties. That's been going on for some time. Does that exist outside of Itasca and Cass counties that you're aware?
Ms. Sesh.
Well, we have White Earth that has tribal courts, and we have Leech Lake that has tribal courts. But if the case is in the county, the problem that we have is the social workers who either have been trained in ICWA and choose to ignore it. They are actually telling the residents, this is not an ICWA case. You are not American Indian. And it is not up to anyone else other than the tribes to say. I'm working on one case right now where in the petition itself, when the petition was filed last November, it said that the Indian Child Welfare Act did not apply, but the mother told the county more than a year before that she was Indian. So as a result of that, the tribes are not being sent the required notice. They're not being sent the notice the way it's supposed to be. Notice is supposed to be sent registered mail, return receipt requested. I was just at White Earth, and they showed me a whole bunch of notices sent to them from counties here in Minnesota, first-class mail, which is against, you know, which is not the law. So I'm spending my time trying to educate people and remind them about the Indian Child Welfare Act and NIFPA, but in the meantime, we also have these other cases that I'm trying to work with the families so that the children are actively reunified with family as fast as possible, as long as it is safe for them to be there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell.
Just a quick follow-up. I'd like to learn more about what we might be able to do to remedy that situation, to be helpful, if there's something that the state of Minnesota can do to be helpful. And you know, we can continue that. That's probably more of a conversation than for this setting. But
thank you. Number one would be to increase the budget so that we would have enough monies in the budget to educate, and it's not just educating as to the counties, it's also educating the families as to what is ICWA, when does ICWA come into play. I have several cases right now that the families have said that they are Indian, but the tribes have come back and says that it doesn't apply, so it takes up other resources, because people think that if they just say that they're ICWA, that they're going to get special recognition they can follow the ICWA rules, but that's not the way it is. It's up to the tribe to decide if the children are eligible for membership. So the first thing is on the budget. If we had an investigator working for the office, that would also be able to help, not just with the cases that I work on, but with the other cases that the other ombudspersons works on. And then the budget will also be able to provide monies. There are board members that need to pay for gas from out of their own pocket in order to travel to our meetings. And when gas is almost $4 a gallon and they're traveling more than 400 miles, that is, you know, a pretty chunk of change out of their own pocket, because we do have a volunteer advisory board. The other thing is, if the counties would just follow the law, then I wouldn't have to do that. And I spoke to one county attorney, I won't say his name, but he said, unless the tribes push back, the counties are going to continue to save their monies and not do what they need to do. And so we shouldn't have to do that. The law is there. Just follow the law.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for your testimony, for coming in.
Thank you, Chair Dean and Committee.
And next up we have Behavioral Health and Therapy, followed by the Dentistry Board and Optometry Board. If you could please make your way up for Behavioral Health. State your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Rexigal, and I'll pause for a pronunciation guide. It sounds a little like bicycle. And I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. And before I provide specific information about the board, I would like to make some general comments about all the health-related licensing boards, and by doing so, hope to save the committee some time by avoiding duplication of testimony. The Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy is one of 15 boards that regulate licensed health professionals in Minnesota. The health licensing boards are co-located in the same office building, and we collectively fund an administrative services unit, which we refer to as the ASU. And the ASU provides, among other things, purchasing, accounting, and human resources services for all the boards. And the ASU first began providing these services in 1994. Later on, you will hear testimony from Ms. Julie Vangsness, the accounting director of the ASU, and she will provide the committee with more specific information, including an explanation of ASU change items in the governor's proposed budget. I believe all of you have been provided with summary information from each board, and those pages outline the mission, purpose, our regulatory strategies, funding, number of regulated persons, complaint number, staffing levels, etc. All of the health licensing boards share many common features. Each board is an independent state agency. Board members, both professional and public, are appointed by the governor. And as you listen to our presentations today, please note that our boards are state agencies created by the legislature to protect the public. And we regulate the professions. We do not advocate for them. They have professional associations that most ably take care of that for them. So though we often work with professional associations, we do have distinctly different missions. Each board is funded through licensure and other fees that are deposited in the state government special revenue fund. I'd like to stress that the boards receive no general fund dollars. However, I did note on the change item page for the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, it appears to be a template that refers to the general fund, but we are fee-based special revenue fund an agency. Again, the boards exist to protect the public in Minnesota by licensing only individuals who meet the requirements for licensure. The boards further ensure public protection by monitoring compliance with license renewal and continuing education requirements. But most importantly, the boards take disciplinary or corrective action against practitioners who engage in unethical, unprofessional, unsafe, or incompetent practice. The boards also refer regulated individuals to the Health Professional Services Program if their ability to practice with reasonable skill and safety is impaired by illness. And illnesses may include chemical dependence or abuse, physical problems, or mental health issues. And you will hear more about the Health Professional Services Program during the Board of Dentistry presentation. And on a recent historical note, some of you may remember that all of the health licensing boards participated in a sunset review process That began in the fall of 2011. And each board was subject to intense scrutiny of every aspect of their operations by the Legislative Sunset Commission. And I'm happy to say that no board was abolished, and one of the findings was praise for our Administrative Services Unit as a model for the efficient use of state resources, and a model that could be replicated in other areas of state government. And for anyone who has interest in the Sunset Commission reports, I believe you can get them on the Legislative Reference Library site. So turning to testimony specific to my board, the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy was created in 2003, and it regulates professional counselors and alcohol and drug counselors in the state of Minnesota. Professional counselors are master's level mental health counselors employed in a variety of settings, and they provide mental health counseling services to Minnesota citizens. Alcohol and drug counselors provide counseling services to persons seeking services to address substance use and abuse. Many of their clients are court-ordered for treatment. Our board has 13 members, 5 professional counselors, licensed counselors, 5 licensed alcohol and drug counselors, and 3 public members. Our board meets quarterly. We have committees that meet on a monthly basis or as needed, and those committees include Complaint Resolution Committee, Application Licensure, and Legislative Committee. The board office is staffed with 5 full-time equivalent employees. There's the executive director, 2 licensing coordinators, and 2 office and administrative specialists. At present, and that would be yesterday when I took the count, the board regulates a total of 4,216 individuals who have an active license to practice. The licenses include 2,715 alcohol and drug counselors, 169 individuals with temporary permits to practice alcohol and drug counseling, 878 licensed professional clinical counselors, and 454 licensed professional counselors. And the ratio of our licensing staff to licensees with an active license is 1 staff member for every 2,108 licenses to keep track of. Which leads me to tell you that the most immediate challenges facing our board are staffing levels and workspace. The number of regulated persons with active licenses doubled between June 30th, 2006 and June 30th, 2014. However, the licensure staffing level has remained the same. And in connection with that, we are also outgrowing our workspace, and we would really like to convert from paper to electronic records, if we could ever find a way to pay for that. So I guess turning to the chart on our appropriations, in fiscal year 14, our appropriation was $471,000, and in fiscal year 15, it was $488,000. The difference between those two was there was a one-time appropriation of $15,000 made last year to address expedited temporary licensure for members of the military, which is something that we are working on this year in the legislature as well. Our board our budget is largely devoted to staff salaries, just as you've heard today from others. The rest goes to office rent, supplies, equipment. So what I would like to stress is that our board supports the change item included in the governor's budget, and that is for a 1.8% increase in the base budget for the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. As we are fee-funded, I would like to tell you that we do have a positive balance in the Special Revenue Fund, and we do collect sufficient revenue to fund this proposed increase. That concludes my comments. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about health-related licensing boards in general and Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy in particular.
Thank you, Ms. Reitzkel. Any questions? No questions. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And next up, we have the Dentistry Board. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marshall Schrag. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. The Board of Dentistry was actually initially instituted in 1885. I've only been the director for the last 15 years, however. We regulate over 17,000 dental professionals. Back in 1885, it was just dentists. Now we regulate dentists, dental therapists, dental hygienists, and dental assistants throughout the state. Excuse me. Our board also acts as the administering board for the Health Professional Services Program, HPSP. As you heard, a joint program of the boards and the Department of Health that was established to ensure that health professionals with illnesses that may impair their ability to practice safely are appropriately monitored. Monica Feider, to my right, the program manager of HPSP, joins me at the desk, and she will address the committee with an overview of HPSP following my comments. The change items for the Board of Dentistry that are included in the governor's budget, if you look in your Board of Dentistry packet on page 5, those are described. There are 5 of them. We're looking for a staff salary adjustment of $50,000 for the year. That includes the 1.8 that the other boards are receiving, but it also fully funds a halftime position that we've been waiting to fill until we had the full funding. We actually hope to be able to do that with funds towards the end of this fiscal year and be able to carry that on with those continuing funds. We're looking for an increased $16,000 a year for a part-time staff dentist. We currently have that person as an intermittent employee and will continue to use that person, but in this last session, what we found out in the last fiscal year, we had utilized that person's resources fully halfway through the year, and by January, we were no longer able to refer cases to him. He, as I said, reviews and analyzes complex cases on behalf of our complaint committees and has a special experience in detecting and investigating fraud. So a very important part of our team. We're looking at rent increases of $2,000 a year. The communications would help us with software and other resources to be able to communicate better through email systems and monitor those email systems in order to be able to get information out to our licensees. We're also looking at an additional, or actually a replacement, $14,000 a year in travel. This isn't travel for fun and games. It's travel because our board is very much involved in examinations for all licensed dental professionals throughout the region and the country, and also internationally, because we're involved in test development for the National Examining Board of Canada, and participate in development of exams there as well. So our board is very involved in committee work, but committee work that takes them across the country. The total of those change item increases is $84,000. I'd also like then to draw your attention to the page 1, our agency profile in the packet. You look at our historical spending, and that chart looks a little bit scary because all of a sudden in 12-13 it jumps to what looks like almost double. Our spending for the Board of Dentistry didn't actually increase that much. As I indicated, the HPSP, the Health Professional Services Program, is not a state agency. It's a program of the boards and needs an administering board in order to have its funding flow through. We took on that responsibility several years ago, and just in 12-13 is when that actually got formally changed to our budget, and so that shows the addition of HPSP on there, so please don't be scared. I'd also like to then draw your attention to page 7 for my next comments, which is related to a request for fee increases. The Board of Dentistry is now operating in the red. We anticipated in the last biennium, as we are looking now, we had had a continual growth of the number of licensees, but we've experienced a rather sudden and dramatic leveling off of that growth with the number of dental professionals licensed. The steady increase that we'd seen in licensure up until the current biennium hit a ceiling. As a result, I had to report to our board in October that we would need to consider a fee increase. The fee increase, if approved, will bring the board into a positive cash flow during the calendar year of 2019. This projection anticipates the fee increase and takes into account the change item proposals in the budget. On the bottom of page 7, the chart that addresses our fee increase, you'll notice that there's a column entitled Proposed Actual Charge and another entitled Proposed New Maximum Fee in Statute, or Fee Max in Statute. The Board of Dentistry statutes are a little unique in that they outline our fees as a not-to-exceed amount. The dollar amount that the board anticipates charging for license renewals is the lower amount shown in the proposed actual charge. However, the maximum, or the not-to-exceed amount, is what should be adopted in statute. This allows the board to readily adjust fees in response to changing circumstances, either up or down. The Board of Dentistry has not raised fees since approximately 1994, and in 1999 actually reduced our fees. They stayed at the reduced level until 2012, when our fees were adjusted to the previous level. It's been over 20 years since the Board of Dentistry has proposed a fee increase. The board appreciates that this is not something that you take lightly, and neither do we. Although we and our licensees would prefer not to be taking this step, the associations representing our licensees understand that it is not avoidable. I'm happy to respond to any questions that you have now, or if you would like, after Ms. Spider's comments.
Seeing no questions, why don't you please proceed?
Thank you. Chair Dean and members of the committee, my name is Monica Feiter. I'm the program manager of the Health Professional Services Program. Minnesota's Health Professional Services Program, or HPSP, protects the public by providing monitoring services to health professionals with illnesses that may impact their ability to practice safely. Health professionals are referred to us by themselves, third parties, which are often treatment programs, employee health programs, colleagues, and supervisors, and they're also referred by the health licensing boards, either with or without disciplinary action. Similar to the health licensing boards, our primary focus is public protection. Our principal functions are to determine whether health professionals have an illness that warrants monitoring, and if they do, to develop a participation agreement and monitoring plan, which is a contract that we use to protect the public and support long-term illness management. We then monitor the individual's ongoing compliance with the monitoring contract, and if there are any issues in terms of compliance with the contract, we have the ability to request practice restrictions or limitations, and we also report or discharge licensees to their health-related licensing board. Minnesota's Health Professional Services Program is unique from other programs nationally in that it monitors people with substance, psychiatric, and medical disorders. Other states are getting on board with that, but we're still, have led the charge in that area in terms of looking at all illnesses for regulated health professionals. With that, I'd like to conclude my comments and address any questions you might have.
Any questions? Not seeing any questions. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lieblinghaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Feiter, we made some changes to your statute in the last biennium, and I know there are some issues that might have arisen with that we might need to make some more adjustments to that. But I'm just wondering, since we're here talking about the budget, whether you've seen any trends as a result of the changes that we made that would impact the budget.
Ms. Feiter.
I don't see any factual trends. Our numbers are down from last year, but the number of referrals actually increased. This is the first time that we've seen an increase in board referrals or board non-disciplinary referrals being more than self-referrals, but the self-referral rate or number is still higher than what we saw last year. Anecdotally, the thing that we're running into is practitioners who call us to report themselves, and when we provide our Tennyson warning and explain the different areas that we would need to report them to their licensing board on, they say, well, why am I reporting to this program? I thought it was confidential. So that has been a challenge, but we're working with licensees to understand the importance of reporting their illnesses either to our board or to or our program or their board.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, this isn't the right time to go in fully into this, but just so people, members of the committee, kind of get an idea. So there was some either disagreement among, I think it's more a language ambiguity, has sort of resulted in an interpretation that when people are reporting to the board, that whatever they tell the board they've done is then reportable to their licensing board. And that was not our intention, or at least it wasn't mine, in passing the language. So I think that's what Ms. Feider is referring to, and we'll probably hear more about that as we go on, but I just wanted to give that context to her comment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Any concluding remarks?
None. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you so much for coming in today. And next up, we have the Optometry Board. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Randy Snyder, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Optometry, also the Minnesota Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators, part-time for both, and co-lead or fiscal agent for the Administrative Services Unit, and you'll hear Julie Vagsness' request for change items coming up. For years, the Board of Optometry has been fortunate to fiscally manage their operations without a significant reset to their budget, but we must add fees and increase appropriation for this session to meet our core function and essential services, and appreciate the Governor including that in his budget. I'll just quickly outline this to keep to the budget items only, as I think you have the room only until 2:15, so we'll try to make this efficient for you. There are 1,060 licensed optometrists. About 75% of the population requires vision correction to be successful in their daily living, so we have a very important mission. To the budget, the board has not increased fees on license renewals since 1984. I seriously doubt I'll be able to ever say that in my career again, but for 31 years, the board has not increased license fees, and so we are here today. We have full support of our associations, understanding our prudent past management of our fees, but currently we do not collect enough fees sufficient to cover our 2015 budget, so we'll have to reduce for this year, and our request is really on a past efficient fee structure combined with increased salaries, rent, board meetings, and that we find ourselves in need of this adjustment. The appropriation amount or spending authority is $30,000 in FY16 and another $35,000 in FY17. We have the fees, or with the fee changes, we will have enough to cover that. We do have a standalone bill that will be coming back to policy, so I will defer those comments until that point. We have another bill for this session. We are all fee-supported, no general funds. The average fee nationally is $212 for a license renewal, and even with this change, we'll still be 37% less than the average. So we are still a very prudent operation and efficient as we can be. There are 7 board members that give us that direction to be so, do an excellent job. There are 0.9 staff that fulfill the needs of that board, and that is essentially it. We appreciate the Governor's support of putting that in his budget, and since this is a budget committee, I'll leave it to those budget comments only, Mr. Chair, and I thank you, members, for your attention today and stand for any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Any questions? Seeing none, we appreciate your testimony, and if you do have another fee increase in 31 years, we'd welcome you back in 2046. Hope you're still with the board. That's love to see you.
Thank you for your generosity. I do have the other board, and they only have the 1.8%. Should I finish that up for you, sir?
That would be great. Thank you, sir.
Yes. I'm also the executive director for the Minnesota Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators. They are equally a wonderful board with a great mission, a lot on their plate. The only item that we have, though, for you, this committee, is that we are in the 1.8 salary wage increase, and so that is a matter of $2,000 and $4,000, so hopefully the state of Minnesota will be able to, our fees are able to cover that this time. We will be having a policy budget in the next biennial budget period, so that will be in 18-19, I guess, is what we're looking at. So, Mr. Chair, the Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators, members of the committee, do a very efficient job, and we don't have any other spending requests that were included in the governor's budget at this time. Any questions?
I don't think so. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we have the Pharmacy Board. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Beth Ferguson, and I have served as the Deputy Director for the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy since October of 2013. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Cody Weiberg, the board's Executive Director, who is enjoying some time away from the office. The Board of Pharmacy was established in 1885 to protect the public by promoting the safe distribution of pharmaceuticals and the provision of quality pharmacy care. The board staff licensed pharmacists, pharmacy interns, pharmacies, drug manufacturers and wholesalers, controlled substance researchers and medical gas distributors, and registered pharmacy technicians. The number of licensees are included within page one of your document. It's important to note that the number of individuals licensed by the board has increased by 49% during the past decade. Both board surveyors inspect in-state facilities for adherence to state and federal laws and rules relating to the practice of pharmacy. They also investigate jurisdictional complaints and provide consultative advice to promote adherence to laws and rules. The Board of Pharmacy also administers the prescription monitoring program. I'm here to outline the governor's budget. The Board of Pharmacy has received approval from the governor to seek an increase in its appropriation in the amount of $114,000 in fiscal year 2016 and $155,000 in fiscal year 2017, as seen on page 7 of the report. The governor has also authorized the board to request an increase in fees to offset the appropriation request, and that is projected to generate an additional $379,000 in revenue annually, and that is seen on page 9 of your report. The fee increase is larger than the requested increase in appropriations because of an increase in indirect costs, including payments to the Attorney General's Office, Health Professional Services Programs, Administrative Services Units, and to cover the apportioned costs for the Prescription Monitoring Program's annual appropriation. The Board of Pharmacy needs an increased appropriation to cover the cost of hiring a complaint coordinator to better manage the increasing number of complaints the board is receiving. Due to several factors, the board has seen the number of complaints that need to be annually processed triple since fiscal year 2008. There are also increased costs related to the handling of disciplinary cases. More cases require disciplinary action because the board is able to substantiate allegations that serious violations of statutes and rules have occurred. And some of these cases have involved compounding of drugs in a substandard manner, the theft of controlled substances, and also illegal drug wholesaling. There are also increased costs for in-state travel for inspections and complaint investigations. And of note, that the number of facilities licensed by the board has increased by 31% during the past decade. The recommended fee increase is necessary to cover the cost of the increased appropriation that the board is requesting, and also to address year-over-year growth in the board's operational expenses. If approved, this will be the second fee increase that the board has had during the past 15 years. By contrast, the average length of time between prior fee increases dating back to the early 1950s was every 3 years. Ooh. Those are my comments, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the committee for their time and the governor for their recommendations, and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Ferguson. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming in today. We do appreciate that. And next we have the Social Work Board. Please state your name for the record. Proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dean and members of the committee. I'm Kate Zacherpate. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And first and foremost, the board really does thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of the governor's budget, which we are very much in support of. I'll give you just a very brief background about the board, and then I will speak more specifically to the change items that are included in the governor's recommendations. The board was created in 1987, and we do have a 15-person board, a citizen-based board, and five of those 15 members are members of the public who bring that very important perspective to the work that we do at the board. And that is, you know, as you've heard, our mission is really to ensure public protection. We do that by licensing social workers, investigating and resolving complaints made by citizens, and also, very importantly, educating social workers and the public about the Board of Social Work and licensing responsibilities. A quick snapshot about what the licensed professionals, the social work profession, looks like today in Minnesota. We are currently regulating well over 13,000 licensees across the state. The board has four different social work licenses that we are authorized to issue. We issue licenses at a bachelor's level, a graduate degree level, and then also have two independent practitioner levels at an advanced generalist non-clinical license and also an independent clinical license. And all of that information is provided in a little more detail in your packets. Another important fact that I would like to bring to your attention is that over the last 7 years, the Board of Social Work has really experienced unprecedented growth. Our applications and licenses granted have increased over 50%. Our total number of current licensees has increased over 22%, and we have been able to manage that level of increase with no additional staffing. And that actually is one of our current challenges, to maintain our level of service in a timely fashion. Being more specific to the change items, and that information is in your packet, I would draw your attention to page 6. And as the other boards you will be hearing from, we have also been received the proposal from the governor for the 1.8% increase in compensation. So what that looks like for our board in particular, FY16, that is an increase of $14,000. FY17, that is an increase of $28,000. And so that will be an increase to our base budget of $42,000, which we appreciate very much. The second change item that is in your packet is also connected to policy initiatives that the board will be bringing forward this session. And I won't speak a whole lot to the policy initiatives, hoping to come back to those committees later. But what is required in order to move the policy initiatives, therefore what is included as a change item, is the creation of two new fees. And again, that's necessary in order to support these policy initiatives. What that means in terms of change items and additional revenue is $13,000. That's not right. $3,000 is what I meant to say. It is an estimated revenue increase of $3,000 for fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 17. And very briefly, what these two new fee changes are. One is a license late fee, whereby the board is really hoping to take a more creative approach and to add another tool to the enforcement of unlicensed practice that is not a disciplinary approach. So this would be a fine that we would be able to, a fee that we would be able to handle administratively, and it just really would have benefits across the board. To sort of set this in context, how this would be implemented is that this new license late fee would include a $100 flat fee amount, and then licensees who have been determined to be engaged in unauthorized practice would then pay the prorated monthly fee amount that would be added to that $100 flat fee. To sort of give you some context for that, the prorated fee is based on our licensing fees. So our licensing fees range from $81 for a 24-month period for our bachelor's license, which is $3.37 per month, up to our independent clinical license, which is $238.50 for a 24-month period. So again, we would work out a formula that we could incorporate this license late fee as an alternative to discipline. The second new fee that is being proposed is an emeritus active license fee. Now, the fee that would be included for this is essentially we would be able to reduce those licensing fees by 50% as an incentive to try to bolster the workforce by hopefully providing an incentive to individuals, licensed social workers, who are retired. And this emeritus active license would give them then the authority to be able to practice in volunteer pro bono capacities and to also to be able to provide licensing supervision, for which there is a real great need in the state for licensed professionals. And so again, the goal there is to better leverage our workforce and really address some of the mental health workforce shortages that we know exist today. And lastly, in terms of the Emeritus Active license, that actually has been a recommendation that was included in the Minnesota Mental Health Workforce Development Plan. And so we are sort of dovetailing on that initiative as well. And so that, I think, concludes my comments, unless anyone would have questions for me. And as I said, the board is very excited to bring forward those policy proposals. So we hope that we will be revisiting some of you soon. And again, we really do appreciate the governor's proposal to add these initiatives to our base budget.
Thank you so very much for coming today. We do appreciate that. And next up, we have the Administrative Services Unit. And if we could, what we have a shortage of is time. We have 20 minutes and we have 10 boards. So if we could just please perhaps keep the focus of any comments to the change items. All of the members have the packets and the background information in the binders. So if we could just focus on that, that would be much appreciated, and we do apologize for moving things along a little bit. But thank you. Please state your name for the record. Proceed with the testimony.
My name is Julie Vanksis, and I'm the accounting director for the health-related licensing boards. And I have three change items that were included in the governor's budget. The first is the 1.8 operational salary compensation increase. In fiscal year 16, it's a $14,000 increase, and in 17, a $29,000 increase. Our second one is a HLB combined retirement request. This is a one-time request in fiscal year 16 of $320,000 to cover our estimated 15 possible retiring state employees within the health-related licensing boards. The request will cover their cost of their severance payouts and their vacation payouts for these long-term employees. In the past, we've combined this request into one under ASU so that many of the different boards wouldn't have to come forward with a request. This will cover 15 employees that are located within six different boards. And then our third request is for a request to the Minute Data Center and the Tridian cost increase. The first part of it is related to the Minute directive to move our data center from our building to the new Minute Enterprise Data Center. And this will cover the cost to manage that move and the equipment, licensing fees, the backup service, and everything that goes around it. This is an estimated amount from that we've received from Minut would be about $180,000 a year. Our request is a $140,000 increase because we currently have $40,000 that we are paying for that backup service and licensing fees. The second part of it is a $5,000 increase each year to cover the Tridion website hosting. All of our boards now have converted from the old database or an old website hosting to the new Tridion product. That concludes all of the change items in the governor's budget, and I stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for coming in today. We do appreciate it. Next up, we have the Chiropractors Board. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Larry Spicer. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Chiropractic Examiners. I have the dubious distinction of being the first on your list of agenda items, it appears, where I think all the rest of us are subject strictly to the 1.8% increase in the governor's budget recommendation. So to take some direction from you, I would merely say that's it. I'd stand for questions if you want to keep the time short.
All right. Do you have any questions? No questions.
That was tough. Thank you.
I hope you learned something from the other presenters today. Make it worthwhile on the way in. Thank you, sir. We do appreciate you coming in today and the good work that you're doing. Next, we have Dietetics Nutrition Practice.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ruth Grendel. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dietetics Nutrition Practice. I'm also the Executive Director of the Board of Podiatric Medicine, and I'm also speaking for Dr. Wilson from Veterinary Medicine, so I'll speed your agenda up here today. All three boards are in for only the 1.8% inflationary increase and no additional requests. Any questions?
Any questions? We do have the information in our packets, but thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We do appreciate you coming in. And next we have Marriage and Family Therapy Board. Come on down.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, I apologize. I was waiting. I had EMSRB before me on the agenda, so I panicked. I'm Jennifer Mollenhoff. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. I would hate to ruin a good thing. We are here as well with just the 1.8% increase to base budget. So unless there are questions, and if at a later time you ever want to find out a little bit more about what a licensed marriage and family therapist really is, I'd be happy to do that. But I won't take up your committee time at this point.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you so very much for your work and for the testimony today.
Mr. Chairman, I'm with the MSRB, and somehow I didn't get on the list, but I was supposed to go next.
That is my mistake, sir. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is James Denzer, and I am the Assistant Executive Director for the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. I'm here on behalf of Pam Billadue, the Executive Director, who's winding down a lot of projects before she retires from 35 years of state service and 4 years with our agency. Let me just give you a brief note about who we are. Think ambulances and EMTs, but the bigger picture is that 562,000 Minnesotans called 911 and were answered with an emergency ambulance service last year, which means that is probably your neighbors, your relatives, your friends, and your coworkers may avail themselves of our services. Just to give you an idea of what's been happening, we are a general fund only agency. We were originally in 1995 part of the Minnesota Department of Health. We became an independent board in 1996. And just to give you an idea, in 2004, when we first started tracking this, we had 409,000 ambulance runs. We're up to 560,000 today. The spending on per ambulance run has declined from about $2.87 to $1.40 per run. This is in terms of regulatory costs. So we, of course, support the governor's budget that is aimed at keeping our base functions whole and intact, and that will cover increases in salary, increases in our operating costs such as rent, ASU services, minute services, and that sort of thing. So that's about it. I'll keep it short, and I stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be real quick. In the I think in the policy committee, we've heard some bills that took some functions away from the board. And is there any change in the fiscal picture associated with that? I assume you know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you are talking about. This budget was aimed at our primary core functions, which are the inspections, investigations, the certifications. So we were having a hard time. That's why we were having a hard time doing some of those other functions, such as grant management. So our full staffing was, I think, probably about 19, and we're down to about 10. So anything that doesn't go to our core functions, we're, of course, looking for help, and that was what MDH was helping us with.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Appreciate Thank it. You.
Next, we have the Medical Practices Board.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today. We are only seeking your support of the 1.8% increase that will support the Board of Medical Practice in overseeing 28,000 licensees, physicians, and six allied health professions. And if you have questions, I'd be happy to address those.
And you're Ms. Martinez.
Yes.
Any questions? Seeing none, we do appreciate your time today and for all your great work. Thank you. Next up, we have the Nursing Board. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Shirley Brecken. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and there's only two boards after me, so you are going to more than meet your timeline. The Board of Nursing licenses 118,000, almost 119,000 RNs, LPNs, and APRNs, and we are included in the governor's budget with the 1.8 increase of our base budget, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for
thank
coming
Thank you, Mr.
In.
Chair.
We do appreciate it. And next we have the Physical Therapy Board.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Lunning. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Physical Therapy, and to sort of piggyback off the speedy version, the board regulates over 6,300 physical therapists and physical therapist assistants, and we're here to ask for your support of the governor's budget of the one proposed 1.8% increase. Got any questions for me?
Any questions from members? Great. All right, we see none. Thank you so much for coming in today. Appreciate that. And I believe we're going to hear from the Psychology Board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leo Kimpera. I'm the Assistant Executive Director for the Board of Psychology. And like many other of other boards and my colleagues, we are only seeking for the 1.8% increase in the governor's budget. So I stand for any other questions.
Any other questions? Representative Backer. Oh, okay. Seeing no other questions, we do appreciate it, and appreciate all the folks coming in today and with the budget being ready for questions. And special thanks to all of the great professionals your organizations represents across the state of Minnesota and the great job that they do. We do appreciate that. What else? Schedule for next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll have public testimony on the governor's budget, and we'll look forward to that. And with that, we are adjourned.